Accession number 6820, roll number 6.
Mr. Mackenzie, reel 6.
Which edged this road in. We were there until it got light, or began to get light, when the company commander collected the various platoons, and we moved down to a position opposite the Dieppe race course. I had to take over a level crossing, and as the hut, the small cottage there, belonging to the crossing man's railway crossing man's outfit, I took that cottage over and began to work out positions, firing positions for my platoon. I would have favoured using a couple of the houses alongside, two-storey houses, which would have given me pretty adequate observation on the flat ground immediately in front, the race course, and the far ridge of the valley leading into Dieppe. However, the company commander coming round with the second-in-command, who had now become CO because our CO had taken over the brigade, Colonel Barclay, he had taken over from the brigade commander, another ex-Seaforth. I had to act on instructions from the now commanding officer, who was also an old Seaforth, Andrew Bonner, Major Bonner. Who has had always been a better bookkeeper than a tactician, at least so it seemed to us. He insisted that we didn't use any of the houses or any of the cover that was available. We had to dig slit trenches in the marshy ground in front, and it was marshy, and one couldn't go very deep. Once you were into those positions, there was absolutely no field of fire at all because of the hedges in front. However, this that had to be done, and the lads themselves dug shallow slit trenches and made the best of it. Just in front of the position I was now occupying, I discovered numbers of men, quite a few, who had no organisation whatsoever. They all seemed to be living on their own or in very tiny groups. And they'd come from sort of every unit under the sun and drifted there. Even some guardsmen, I warned them that they'd better not be there if any firing had to be done, because they were in my immediate fire zone. And I questioned one of them, what are you doing here? He said, well, we can get rations here. We lost our own troops. And I said, where do you get rations from? He says, that's the DIDS, a Divisional Indent Supply Depot, or Depot Supply. It's a Scots officer over there. So he took me over to the DIDS, and I was introduced to a Lieutenant Martin, RESC of the 51st Division. who proved extremely friendly, said I could take what I wanted from the depot, and showed me, he opened several doors. It had been a farmhouse, I should think, or a farmsteading. There was huge doors leading back into alleyways with some of them had vast quantities of meat hanging up on hooks, and others had stacks of bread. There was a huge quantity of cigarettes, and it was a sort of Aladdin's cave. Now, I was torn between the idea of my lads having sufficient to eat and plenty to smoke, and being able to carry it without dumping their ammo. However, we had a good supply of all these things from Lieutenant Martin, and I'd two or three cases of meat and veg, and we set about having a good meal. It was one of the brighter moments of the campaign. I had my Corporal Good, Willie Good, who was acting as my platoon sergeant then, me having taken over the platoon. I told him to get on with the meal. We found some potatoes which we liberated in the crossing man's hut, and I took the runner, Hutchison, and we went up to find out where the company commander had pitched his headquarters, to tell him all about the, I've got down in my story, the manor in our midst, and it was certainly manor of no mean quality, what we discovered. Got up there and told them about it, and I, on the way back to the position, there was a small cafe there which we went in to have a drink at, and there was a little Jew with his wife who came up to me and produced a huge roll of notes and asked me if I could give him a place in one of my trucks. I could have all this money. So, of course, I told them not to be at all worried about getting away, as we weren't going anywhere. We were there to defend the town of Dieppe. And he tried every means he could to persuade me. It wasn't a chance. And I would say it was about 2 years afterwards that I realised the dreadful, dreadful position that man and his wife were in. Little old man, little old lady. However, that was one of the things that I remember about war. During the course of the afternoon, I was talking to this Lieutenant Martin outside our billet, outside the level crossing on the main road. I was talking to him, and Scott's red cap on a motorbike. Now, the first time I had any sort of real information about what's going on, and this Scots red cap was telling me that he'd been in, I think he said he was in Brussels when the Belgium pulled out. He was in Abbeville when the French and Belgians pulled out, and the British. He says everybody was moving as fast as the next one. However, he wasn't there very long with us. He pushed off, and a DR came looking for Lieutenant Martin with a note, with a message. this must have been quite late in the afternoon, and Lieutenant Martin read the message and said, well, I've got to set fire to the dump, he says, and start moving towards Fécamp. He had to go to Fécamp. And he'd got he'd got a truck and I think about 14 men in his little contingent. And the next thing we could hear, bang, 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 and the old dump went merrily up, and we all thought what we might have had if we'd been a bit earlier. So up went the dump, and fire, flames, and we hung about there until it got quite dark. Pretty well the whole of that day there had been stuff going over our heads. Just masses and masses and masses of bombers. And of course one watched each wing of the bombers as they came over to see, waiting for them to curl down and give us hell. And strangely enough, none of them did. But we anticipated, we suffered in anticipation, I'll put it that way, until they'd sheared off. We had to go up to, had to go up again to the company headquarters, and Major Murray had received the news of what was going on. And the story up to that moment was 70 fresh divisions of Jerry's had attacked and burst through in the direction of Rouen. That would be away on the right of the 51st Division, which had done a very complicated manoeuvre in changing its flanks round, sort of in mid-air. We were at one time on the right, now here we were on the left, facing the prospective approach of the enemy. Mm-hmm. And the story was that we were to go to battalion headquarters to move there and be ready to move out from Dieppe at dawn. From Dieppe at dawn. Which we did. We moved, first of all, from our positions on the main road up to the chateau where the headquarters were, and we rested there for possibly a half hour or so. And the Duke of Wellington's carriers, they roared off down the slope to take up the positions that we'd just vacated, the carriers of the Duke of Wellington's. And having watched them off, given them a cheer, we formed column of route and off we went, marching out of Dieppe as dawn was breaking. And what would that be? Would it be about the 9th? I think that was the 9th of June. And we marched out of Dieppe and were almost at once and almost continuously attacked by Stukas and fighters. And they were taking pot shots at anything that was moving on the road, and there was plenty. There was an awful lot of refugee traffic. And of course, it didn't make anything any easier for us. Nothing very much we could do except take to the ditch on one side or another of the road. And anybody who's been in France on that sort of job, anyway, must remember that French roadside ditches are very, very smelly things. However, we kept going. Out of Dieppe, climbed on the far side up the main road, then turned right and marched all morning, the rest of the morning. We came to a little village, I'm not sure of its name, but it was on the far side of a river, crossed that river and took up positions. We started to dig slit trenches just on the other side of this river. And we were there when orders came through that all spare kit was to be burned. We were only allowed to take things of the utmost sentimental value out of our kit that we could carry, like things like family photographs, nothing heavy. Another thing which struck me as being very strange at the time was that we were to retain one Boyce rifle per company and the other two were to be burned or made useless or buried. Now, and most of the Boyce rifle ammunition was also either destroyed or buried at that time. Now, it wasn't only to us, it was general throughout the division, apparently. And many years afterwards, I had a German who'd been following us up, saying that the main job that they were given was looking for these particular Boyce rifle because they thought they were a wonderful weapon. We had not much faith in them ourselves, but they were a very good standby to the Germans, apparently, and they got a lot of them. And that's, by the way, at that particular place, I was talking to the company commander. He'd got a message just handed to him, and it was that the Germans had penetrated to St. Valley. That we were to move in our own transport and try to make Fécamp. That we were to move off as soon as the Duke's carriers had passed through our line. Duke of Wellington's carriers who'd relieved us earlier. Now, I said to her, I'd got an old school jotter with a map on the back which covered that area to a certain extent. Now, there are two St. Valeries. There's one north of the Somme, or at the mouth of the Somme, and there's one at the mouth of the Caux. And the St. Valery that I pointed to was the one at the Somme. And he says, no, I'm afraid not. He says, that's the one down there, which, of course, was immediately in our path on the way that we were deciding to go. He shook his head, as much as say, well, there isn't much chance. While we're talking, the carrier's lieutenant came into the scene again, W.W. Cheyne, Cheyne. He came tearing along in his carrier, and he'd been out, and he said, hurry, lads, he says, we're going to get picked up. He says, I think he said a repulse, some other renowned repulse, yes. He said, waiting off the beaches for us, 36 hours and we'll be back in Blighty. Of course, the lads heard and we all give a cheer. He was incurably optimistic, was Cheyne. Which, of course, is a good quality too. We doubled off our own transport, battalion transport, turned up. And we were just packed like sardines into our own vehicles. Hardly room to breathe. I was fortunate to be able to sit in front of the truck with a driver, and I could hear my lads at the back tearing the canvas with their bayonets so that they could breathe. So nobody worried very much because we knew it was hit or miss. We were going to be lucky if we got through the next phase. And we tore like that for, well, I suppose 2-3 hours, into St. Valley. Now, just before we moved off, I had orders to support the 14th platoon, I think it was, and clear a machine gun that had been reported. However, we never saw the machine gun. We passed a couple of Jerry armoured cars which had been blown up on the route. Of course, realised that there wasn't a great deal of chance with their vehicles about, but we were going to do our best. There was quite a lot of hope. Tore along down into the little town of St. Valley. Now, that's a fishing port, and it's also a pleasure resort, small pleasure resort, on the Normandy coast. It's has a river running through it, and I suppose it's tidal up to a certain point. And it's very like Dover in many ways, particularly that it nestles down below white chalk cliffs. Very, very high chalk cliffs on each side of the river, along the sea edge. Now, we pulled in there, just gathering dusk, halted at the bottom of the slope into the town, and I got out of my truck and could see a couple of tanks, light tanks there, belonging to the Lothian and Border Horse. They were one of our armoured units, if you could call them armoured, and they were pointing back in the... had got their gun pointing back in the direction we'd come from. I got out of my truck and went across and asked about the news, what news was, and they said, well, it's pretty black. He said, the outposts in the far part of the town have been pushed in. And he said, so far as we know, that you're pretty well the last people coming down. The town was a complete shambles at that particular time. It was full of demoralised troops, French troops. They'd had their lot. They didn't want to fight anymore, and there was explosions all over the place. There had been a bombing raid earlier on, and the whole area was full of charred, bits of charred wood. It's an experience I've had once or twice in that sort of era. They got at least little bits of charcoal got in your eyes, got in your ears, got up your nose, got in your mouth. They're very unpleasant. And there seemed to be a grumbling undertone of noise through the town. There were several trucks and cars trying to get back out the way we'd come in. There was one car, a limousine, with a French officer with a beautiful kepi and a more beautiful lady alongside him, and he was moving out in that direction. I don't know what his idea of where he was going to go. No doubt he's got his plans. But he moved off that way. And I wasn't there very much longer talking to this driver when a couple of bullets bunged off the ground around me. So whoever had a go at me, I don't know It may have been fifth columnist, it may have been one of the Frenchmen. I skipped back to my truck, and very shortly afterwards, somebody came along. Yes, a naval officer came along and said to our Andrew Bonner, it's all ready now for evacuation. Now get your troops down there while the tide's in the right direction. Get them down here at the right. Andrew said, no, my orders are to stay here and fight. He wouldn't budge. So that was one opportunity. I really don't know. He probably did the right thing, the right soldierly thing to do. His orders were, you know, to stay there, and he got further orders. And I had this naval officer distinctly tell him that the way was open for him to fetch his troops down onto their boats, which were waiting to take us out to the fleet.
This was an RN, was it?
Yes, he was a naval officer. Now, farther back in the direction we'd come is a town called Ville-les-Roses. V-E-U-L-E-S hyphen L-E-S hyphen Roz, I think it is. I'm almost certain. And I think one of our companies, or a patrol from one of our companies, had moved down there and was successfully evacuated. It was a destroyer from Dover Patrol, who knew my wife's parents, who used their pub at that particular time, who was actually looking for me. I heard several years after, looking for me, asked about me, said, oh, last we heard of me, he was looking for a machine gun. They got garbled account of my orders, I was to be in support of an attack on a machine gun. But this destroyer, my wife remembered the name, but she was cut in half by a bomb a little later on. And when I came home to Dover, half of this particular destroyer was lying up in the shingle.
So it was destroyed on the way back to Dover?
No, it was destroyed later on, you know, at around about that time, you know, when they really did belt Dover. Wish I could remember it. So, we were still in our trucks. The CO, or acting CO, Andrew Bonner, had turned down the offer from the Navy. And the next thing, it was getting dark, and along came our company commander and said, all right, everybody out the trucks. And the battalion moved into the town. Now, there is a river goes through, and it's called the Caux, C-A-U-X, St. Valerie and Caux. And I remember moving with my platoon and my company, and we, I suppose, about a quarter of a mile up here, and we had to halt.